Isn't it remarkable when we talk about fictional characters like they are real people? We relate with their experience, or they touch us, or annoy us, or frighten us, or fill us with a warm feeling about life. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Caitlin Hamilton Summey is a steady and deliberate writer whose words flow and pull us into its currents and eddies of family, legacy, love, and loss. Caitlin joins me a little later in the broadcast with her novel, Geographies of the Heart, a follow-up to her book of short stories, To Lay to Rest Our Ghosts. I look forward to sharing our conversation with you. Coming up, I speak with Barbara Graham, whose novel is What Jonah Knew. The author grounds her book, which is a psychological thriller, in the realities of family, spiritual belief and practices, trauma, and scientific exploration of past lives, none of which seem esoteric or beyond credulity as she challenges our perspectives and encourages us to reflect on motherhood, family, and grief. Both Summey and Graham have substantial literary accomplishments, and for each, this is a first novel. Stay with us for Caitlin Hamilton Summey and Barbara Graham. It's a novel idea. Barbara Graham has been writing for magazines for years and has penned several best-selling nonfiction books, including Women Who Run with Poodles, Myths and Tips of Honoring Your Mood Swings, and her memoir, Camp Paradox, which reveals that the love affair she experienced as a young girl with a camp counselor at an all-girls summer camp was actually sexual abuse. What Jonah Knew is Barbara's first novel. The book is a literary thriller and will appeal to those who enjoy mysteries. However, this isn't what I would call escapist fiction or a lightweight whodunit. Barbara's characters are well-grounded in a searing reality, and the book explores issues of inherited family trauma, metaphysical notions of reincarnation, and the extent mothers will go to keep their children safe. Here is our conversation. Barbara Graham, welcome to talk about your book, What Jonah Knew.
Thank you so much, Suzanne. Thanks for having me.
Before we launch into the narrative and the details of the story, I'd like to first dive into some of the larger concepts. But I think for our listeners and readers, we should just provide kind of a generalized overview. And the story is about a little boy, Jonah, who seems to have the memories of another person, and that person is deceased. So the story deals with the families of both Jonah and the dead person. And so we'll get into all that in a minute. I'd first like to talk with you a little bit about the notion that you bring up in the book of inherited human trauma. The mother of Jonah, Lucy, wonders if this could be why Jonah is having night terrors, and she thinks she herself has inherited trauma. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yes, it's an incredibly interesting subject to me. And a few years ago, I was helping a friend who was publishing a book that's become incredibly successful called It Didn't Start With You, Mark Wallin. He's a therapist who does inherited family trauma work. So I became really familiar with the research, and the research is quite compelling. They've shown that at least three generations of descendants are affected, and often in the form of PTSD or phobias, all kinds of acting out of family members, ancestors who've undergone some kind of trauma. And so I became quite fascinated with that. And not just, you know, as sort of external research, but really in terms of my own life. My grandmother often talked about being a little girl in her shtetl outside of Vilna and being stoned by the Cossacks. And so I think so many of us carry, there's been so much so many terrible things going on in the world, so many wars and famines and everything throughout history, I think many of us really carry some kind of residue, some kind of imprint from the trauma experienced by our ancestors. And many of us are not aware of it. And the research is really relatively new and is becoming more compelling. I read a recent study about the Tutsi in Africa and Tutsi women who were pregnant when the horrible uprisings took place, compared to Tutsi women who were not living in the area where the uprisings took place. Their children were far more stressed and exhibited many more signs of trauma. And that's a very recent study.
That's interesting in that we maybe might put more credence into, playing classical music to your swollen pregnant belly to somehow create some atmosphere for your child. But we maybe don't think about that whole thing of trauma.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I also think that sometimes there's just a sadness about somebody, and you notice that that's in their family, that they are just seem like a sad or a troubled family. And sometimes the people in the family themselves don't really know where that comes from.
Exactly.
And it could be that they really don't know where it comes from. But I found that an interesting thing you brought up in the book. And though the book is a thriller and has that aspect of the story, I found the humanity in each one of the characters was really what made the story. And in the story, a lot of the characters do have something in their past, and you don't reveal it all at once. For instance, Kip is a character we only hear about. We never meet him. We don't get to know him. Yet he influences some core decisions made by some of the characters. And you just kind of drop at one point that Kip's dad hung himself. So that gets back to that whole idea of inherited trauma. Well, so this might be a good time to outline some of the story. So why don't you give a little bit of an overview?
Sure. So what Jonah knew, it's the story of two mothers and their sons. At the outset of the novel, they don't know one another, but there are crises brewing in each family. So Helen's musician son, Henry, has mysteriously disappeared, and she's completely frantic trying to figure out what happened. It's very out of character for him, but the police treat it as if, you know, it's no big deal because hundreds of thousands of people disappear every year, many voluntarily, and they're not in the beginning interested in pursuing the case or even making it a case. And so that's going on, while at the same time, Lucy's son, Jonah, who we really get to know most when he's four, he shows signs of PTSD. He has night terrors, he has anxiety, and just lots of fearfulness, no known cause. And this is where the ancestral trauma piece comes in. Lucy had family members who were killed at Auschwitz. And so she believes that she's a health reporter and a health editor at a magazine. And it's her belief that Jonah is showing signs of trauma exhibited or suffered by her family members in the camp. So she pursues that line. And when Jonah turns 7, he has a major episode when the near bombing happened at Times Square, but a lot of actually firecrackers went off. The bomb didn't. Jonah panics, and Lucy persuades her husband, Matt, that they would be well advised to spend the summer in upstate New York, get out of the city, get out of where this episode took place, and, you know, have a really calm, beautiful summer and to try to regulate Jonah's nervous system. And of course, they go to the small town in upstate New York where Helen lives. It's many years later after Henry's disappearance. He's still disappeared. And Jonah starts having these memories of Henry as if they had happened to him. This is so outside of all the characters' belief system, but it's something that they are really forced to explore. And one of my favorite characters in the book is Charlie the dog, who seems to recognize Jonah.
Yes, Charlie the dog gets to us as the reader too. So, you know, what struck me about both of these mothers, and I would say that this is also a story about motherhood, that
yes.
Lucy, the mother of Jonah, she seems very open to possibilities that she herself doesn't understand, and seeks out knowledge or other information, and including talking with some Buddhists. And you have a couple of characters who are Buddhists in the book, one a Zen Buddhist and one a Tibetan Buddhist. And you introduce some concepts that come out of those practices, reincarnation and the bardo. And I wonder if you can explain this for our listeners, especially the concept of the bardo.
Sure. So the bardo, really, there are stages after we die called bardos. And this is the belief of Tibetan Buddhists. The Dalai Lama is an example of a reincarnated, very high Tibetan Lama. So stages following upon death, which is what the Tibetan Book of the Dead is all about, is navigating those stages until we reach what is called the bardo of becoming, which is preparation for rebirth. You know, I've been on retreats and listened to many Tibetan Buddhist teachers talk, and really they talk about past and future lives like last Thanksgiving or, you know, next 4th of July. So it's very much embedded in their belief system. Whereas in Zen, really, the emphasis is much more just on the present life, this moment, this very moment. And so they don't pay too much attention to past and future lives because it takes us out of the moment. So these are threads. You know, when I think about this book, I think that I sort of brought in so many of the things that personally I care about. I'm a longtime meditator and have been on retreats and attended talks by many, many different teachers in different traditions. So all of this kind of came together in kind of a stew in my mind. And the research also on reincarnation done by Ian Stevenson and his team at the University of Virginia Medical School.
So, yes, I thought that the bringing in of that level of research and also of spiritual practice is what really gave the book the depth it has.
Thank you.
Because, you know, it is a driving thriller. Even at some points, we think we know, well, what happened and everything, but there's still questions and wondering about that. And part of it is just these characters who are so grounded in reality. So the story deals with these metaphysical concepts. But how do you, as the writer, thread these concepts in while keeping a tautly paced narrative?
That was the challenge of writing the book. And I felt like I wanted to bring the reader along with the characters who really don't know very much about any of the concepts that are introduced in the book, so that it becomes part of the story as they encounter these concepts and, you know, ancestral trauma, the concept of rebirth, because they are forced to look at them because of Jonah's behavior. And then when they're up in upstate New York with where Helen is, all the confluence of everything that happened to Henry and what Jonah seems to know, the characters really have to look at this stuff that they've never even thought about. So that, I think, was my way of trying to bring in these various concepts, but really within driving the story, driving the plot, so that they weren't just an overlay, but they really moved it along.
You know, you've written several other books and many articles, including a pretty revealing memoir, but this is your first novel. So you just talked about some of these challenges, but I wonder what else surprised you and what drew you to writing this kind of thriller?
Yeah, you know, I've always wanted to write novels, probably more than anything else. And I did start out writing plays, which is another form of fiction. But plays are very different from a novel because the lines that you write are almost scoring for actors, and then they create everything else, what would be description in a novel. So I always yearned to write a novel. And then I spent many years as a journalist writing a lot about health and psychology and memory and trauma and things of that nature, and meditation, mindfulness, and also memoir, hard stuff. But there's something about fiction that just creates the opportunity for going deeper than in memoir, because in memoir, you more or less have to stick to the facts. In novels, you have much more freedom. Jessamyn West said something like, you know, fiction allows you the freedom that reality obscures, something like that. But that said, it was a learning curve because I had not written a novel before, but this one came to me as kind of a download. While walking down the street in New York, I had been researching a story on past life regression therapy for a magazine, and I'd been listening to these various Tibetan Buddhist teachers talking about past and future lives. And then I discovered Ian Stevenson's research with these 2,500 cases of kids, young kids, not adults who do a regression, but kids with spontaneous recall of a previous life and talking in incredible detail of what they seem to remember. And so it all came together in kind of a stew in my mind. I knew the beginning of the book. Well, actually, the beginning of the book changed. I knew where it was going. And then it took me many years stopping and starting to figure out how to get there, and many, many drafts. But I can also tell you, I've never had more fun writing anything than I did this book. The freedom to really bring in what you love, what you care about, what really matters in service of telling a good story was just life-affirming for me. And lots of times I didn't know what would happen next in the book. And I really didn't. I do outlines, but I never stuck to the outlines. And somehow the characters would tell me I'd go for a long walk, and just kind of let it come in, and then I knew what to do next. It's kind of an alchemical, magical process. At least that's how I found it.
And I suppose that's why we can feel in the book, there seems to be times when you really feel the voice of Jonah. Other times you're much more aligned with the voice of Lucy or Helen.
Yeah. And you said earlier, it's a lot about motherhood. It really is a lot about motherhood. almost everything, not everything, but so much of what I've written is about motherhood. I'm the mother of a son who is now quite grown up, but writing Jonah sort of brought me back to when he was a little kid. And for me, writing about motherhood, I think motherhood has been my most profound teacher in life and ongoing. It doesn't stop. And so that was really important to me, to be able to work with the voices of these two women who were quite different, very different backgrounds, but who are both trying to make sense of their lives in relation to their children. And then their lives overlap in a very powerful way from which there's really no turning back.
Yes. And we've just talked about Lucy being the mother of Jonah and her dedication and strength in trying to find out what's going on with her kid and protecting her child. And then there's Helen, who lost her child, Henry. And their story is quite something, too. And as she emerges in this story, there's a lot of warmth about her, despite her sorrow. And she is slowly allowing herself to move out of her intense grief and the hold it's had on her so she can move on into another phase of her own life. And then this situation happens that literally brings Henry back in a way. So talk a little bit about Helen.
Yeah, I love Helen. I actually originally started the book with Lucy and I shifted it to Helen. And in some ways, Helen was the absolute hardest character to write for kind of obvious reasons. Writing about someone who loses a child, I, you know, cannot imagine a greater grief and greater sorrow. But Helen has a lot of pluck, and also as resistant as she is to really exploring whether, initially she's resistant to exploring whether Jonah's memories of Henry are the real thing, she softens to that. But what's interesting to me about both Helen and Lucy is, as you said, Helen in a certain way gets her son back, but in another way, she doesn't at all. And for Lucy, there's both loss and gain for both of them in my own mind, because while Lucy believed that Jonah, whom she adores and really wanted to have a child, is hers alone, right? And yet, in the course of the novel, she discovers that we aren't exactly who we think we are. We are not, you know, if we do, and nobody can prove this in a controlled clinical trial, but if we do carry in some way the memories of who we were in a previous life. And I can give you an interesting description, I find, of how that process occurs, because nobody exactly knows. But if that's true, then Jonah isn't hers alone in the way she might have once imagined. So for both of them, there's definitely loss and there's also gain.
And Helen has compassion for Lucy when Jonah acknowledges that part of him that is Henry. And Helen has compassion for Lucy, that what it must be like to have your son acknowledge another person as his mother.
Yeah.
And I found Helen to be a really wonderful character
in the
book.
I love her.
There are a couple of other mothers in the book as well. Mira, who is Henry's, were they married? Wife? Was she his wife?
They were going to get married. She was pregnant when he disappeared.
but is the mother of Henry's child. And then Lucy's mother, Phoebe, who, you know, she doesn't have a huge role in the book, but I found it somewhat humorous at times, their relationship, but also that Phoebe, who then changes her name, you're going to have to pronounce
Sonam.
Sonam. She herself, I felt, was somebody who was striving for knowledge, for self-knowledge.
Yes.
But there was something, you know, that Lucy could never see that in her mother when they were growing up.
Right.
And it to me, gets back to that whole kind of generational thing. So talk about that.
Yeah, well, you know, Lucy grew up in Point Reyes.
Right.
With a very flaky mother who had her when she was really young. And, you know, this sort of came easily to me. I had my son when I was quite young, although I didn't get knocked up at a Dead concert, which is what happened to Phoebe. Or after, not at the concert, but post Dead concert. So, and, you know, I live in West Marin. So I found that really leavening just to write and fun to write. And Phoebe is trying so hard, and Phoebe has changed and is not the flake and is really wants to cultivate a relationship with her grandson, Jonah, and with Lucy and Matt, Lucy's husband, but makes a couple of missteps, one of which, you know, leads to the climax of the book. Her sort of, yeah, you know, unwittingly, her choice of where to spend the day with the two children, with Jonah and Mira's daughter, the very plucky Lola, who was so fun to write.
Yes, it was when that was all happening in the book. You know, you just want to say, Phoebe, Sonam, no. But
yeah,
so she goes. And then there was Rosaline, who I also felt didn't have a huge role, but she had a weighty one.
Yeah, she did. She is a real voice of wisdom. She's a longtime Zen practitioner. Her pronouncements are sometimes difficult for Helen to hear. But she's an important voice in the book, and she's the one who says, loss is the price we pay for love. And I believe that to be true. I mean, you know, one of the three jewels in Buddhism is, or the three main teachings is impermanence. And so that very much also infiltrated the story.
Yes, yes. I found it interesting that there is a play on shifting identity, not just with Jonah, but with Helen and Henry mm-hmm. and Phoebe, for instance. And I don't know, that was just something I uh-huh. observed, that, and I wondered your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, Helen definitely shifted her identity when she was escaping and running away with Henry when he was five from her abusive husband. So that for sure. And I think Phoebe to Sonam, when she became a devoted Tibetan Buddhist student and an assistant to a Tibetan Buddhist Lama. So that became sort of the deepening and her sense of her true self. So yeah, I didn't really set out. I didn't think about that so much, but you're right. It's very much present in the book. But everyone's real identity, including Helen's and Henry's, because their names changed, are revealed in the course of the book.
I guess I thought it all about transformation in a way that there is the ability in our lives to transform and to emerge into a different space. And that's how I thought of it.
That's wonderful, because honestly, yes, I feel like everything I ever write, that's the theme. That's the story. The real story is transformation. So it's lovely that you saw it that way.
I'm talking with Barbara Graham. The book is What Jonah Knew. Very good to talk to you today. Barbara, is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners and readers with?
The only thing that I think about with readers is just sort of prying open questions about are we our bodies, is you know, about the view of our sort of materialist world that's, you know, that we believe to be bookended by birth and death, and is there something much vaster that we can't ever exactly know, but sense? We can have some sense of it, perhaps. And being able to explore that in the form of a novel was the most fun I've ever had. And it felt like a great gift to find that story to tell. People can find out. My website is barbaragrahamauthor.com, just in case anybody wants to check out the book or me or anything.
Or lots of your other writing
right there. Yeah, absolutely. So,
well, I appreciate your talking with me today, and thanks so
Thank
much.
Thank you, Suzanne. I really enjoyed talking to you.
That was my conversation with Barbara Graham on her novel, What Jonah Knew. I am Suzanne Lang with KRCB's A Novel Idea. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll talk with Caitlin Hamilton Summey with her book, Geographies of the Heart. Stay with us.
Well, I woke up this morning without you.
Another great writer, that was the ever-inspiring singer-songwriter Iris Dement with Calling for You from her album My Life. I am Suzanne Lang with A Novel Idea. Caitlin Hamilton Summey is a writer's writer, meaning other writers admire her craft, and in my mind, that makes her foremost a reader's writer. Her book of short stories, To Lay to Rest Our Ghosts, was critically acclaimed, and now she brings us her novel, Geographies of the Heart. But Caitlin is also a writer's friend and advocate. After a career in publishing, she founded her own publicity and marketing firm, Caitlin Hamilton Marketing and Publicity, and for 20 years has been working with other authors to promote their books. That's a literary life. Geographies of the Heart is a novel of people, of us, imperfect, jealous, presumptuous, and loving people. Her writing pulls you in with her well-crafted prose and narrative structure, which are, like memory, sometimes too honest or too close to painful realities, but also forgiving and compassionate to the characters and to us, the readers. Listen now to our conversation. Geographies of the Heart, Caitlin Hamilton Summey. I'm happy to talk to you today about this novel.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to speak with you.
The people in this book, your characters, are ordinary people. They don't really have a lot of unusual drama in their lives, or any more than most people, at least, which is what makes their experience so extraordinary to us in a way as the reader, because it validates us, our humanity. Loss and bitterness are common themes, and communication and withholding of it are traits of some of the characters, as with some of us. So set up this family for us who's at the center of this novel.
The heart of the novel is Sarah McMillan. She has dedicated her life to her multi-generational family. And at the opening of the novel, she's graduating from college. Her younger sister, Glennie, has made a different choice. She has already begun dedicating herself to her career, which will be medicine. Sarah's husband, Al, whom she meets at the beginning of the novel and later marries, is often the mediator between the two. He's often the one in the family who holds everyone together, whether or not they realize it. Sarah's parents are close by, and her grandparents, at least at the beginning of the novel, live with her parents, as they did when Sarah and Glennie were growing up. The whole family lived in one home.
And as you're describing them, these sisters have a central relationship in the novel. And Al and Sarah's relationship is also central. And the grandparents and their eventual death. I guess what I'd like to talk about, because it interests me so much, and so much of the effectiveness of this book is based on the structure of the book. You know, there's a flow that kind of moves in and out of time and memory, and you shift between voices and characters that gives us a depth to these people and their relationships with one another, but without really describing. So I don't know, I just found that your kind of temporal structure of the book and then the different voices that you use helped create this ethereal flow that to me isn't based on description, but more of a generating of some sort of feeling using, you know, structure and craft. So talk about that if you can.
So that's so interesting that you see the movement in the novel is primarily based on emotion rather than maybe some might say plot. The novel is told by Sarah primarily, but at a certain point, I found myself writing from Al's point of view. I always hear a line, I hear something, and suddenly Al popped up in 2009 at my kitchen table, and I wrote several sections of the book from his point of view, because I think that Al brings a gentleness and a humor that is really important in a story about a family struggling with change and loss. Not all the change is sad, but certainly change is not easy for Sarah. And then as I came toward the end of writing this book, which took me decades, I realized that Glennie needed to have her say. She is not a cardboard character. She's much more complex and deep than I think Al and Sarah saw. And that's not to say that Al and Sarah are diminishing Glennie. I think that part of the problem in this novel is that Glennie distances herself from her family and so only shows one face to even them. And so I think that Sarah and Glennie rightfully don't see all that Glennie is. And I really felt that not only did she need to have a voice, not only did she need to be fleshed out, but in some ways she needed to both explain and defend herself. And I don't think the novel would have worked without her voice. I don't think the novel would have worked without all three of them. In terms of the structure, some of these pieces began as stories. Three of them were in my short story collection, To Lay to Rest Our Ghosts. But many of the pieces had already been written and were not included in the collection. And after the collection was published, I decided I really did want to finish the story of these three people and the family at large. And so I began to pull the pieces together. And the question really became, how do you do that when you have all these pieces? But I felt that keeping the pieces mattered, that there was some kind of natural flow among them. and that trying to put in too many additional pieces or too many linking things wouldn't work. I felt that there was an integrity to those pieces, and so I kept them. In addition to which, ever since I began this story about these people, there was always a family quilt. And I felt that the pieces in this novel were almost like the squares of the quilt that each woman, not the men, just the women in the family, added. It's generation after generation of women leaving one single square to represent their lives. And I felt that that echoed how the book was structured.
Yes, I'm glad you brought up the quilt because, you know, it's not a major part of the story, but it does have significance. You know, it tells the family story. And I think at one point, it might have been Al who makes an observation about how important story, the family story, is to Sarah's family. So that's why I find it very interesting that your story, your presentation of story is, I guess I'm not sure how to describe it, but it is like memory in a way. The story has holes and gaps and the characters make assumptions. And it seems like that's what you've captured in the narrative structure of the way you're telling their story, that we almost don't need all the facts. And that maybe goes back to the quilt, too. They're squares, you know?
It's so interesting. I've never thought of it that way. But while the story is linear, I don't list or depict everything. I don't depict Sarah and Al's marriage, for instance. The actual ceremony is not in the novel. And I've never had somebody point out the way the characters fill in the gaps is a reflection of the structure of the book. But it is. There are gaps in the story that are bridged by, as you said, emotion. Or, you know, there's a line or two in the next piece that clarifies what happened. But part of the problem in this novel is indeed that characters fill in their own gaps. They don't talk to each other. And I think we kind of tend to do that sometimes as people. I think it's very easy to say, oh, well, she must not have come to the event because it isn't a powerful enough event or a big enough party. You know, her car maybe broke down, but sometimes we do this. We come up with reasons that really have no basis in fact, or we take things that have happened and then we learn to sort of see them that way. I think that becomes Sarah's problem. She begins to see Glennie's behavior only in one light, that Glennie's absences from family events are because Glennie doesn't want to be there. And, you know, I would say that sometimes that's true. But yes, that's very interesting. There are gaps, and that does reflect what's happening in the story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I think. Really what drew me in even is seeing the evolution of their family through these slices of character, especially with two sisters that, you know, sisters have unique relationships very often in life, like many sisters, bound by common blood, but not always by common experience or common story, especially with Sarah and Glennie being like, you know, maybe 4 years apart or something like that. They don't communicate the same way. They have different goals. And Sarah observes, and I'm going to say this for our readers and listeners, we're from the same place, but we have different geographies of the heart. And that's where the title of the book comes from. And expectation and disappointment are a big part of their relationship with one another. So I don't know, talk about the sisters a little bit.
For a long time, I viewed this very much as a novel about sisters. It drove how I ended the book. It's reflected in conflicts between sisters in an earlier generation. But toward the end of writing the book, actually very late in the process, I realized it's really more Sarah's story. The lens here is Sarah's. And it has to be, because Glennie often isn't there. But like all relationships in this family, the relationship between sisters is is defining. And Sarah views their relationship as foundational. So when Glennie becomes absent by choice and by necessity for her work, her absence hits Sarah very hard. And I don't think Glennie understands that for a long time. But there's a lot about each other that they don't understand. And it clouds their communication problem, because they're not only making assumptions about each other, and as you point out, are very different people, they express themselves very differently. Sarah is one to talk about things. Glennie will do things, and having done them, is satisfied. She doesn't need to trumpet her successes. She doesn't need to trumpet her good works. She's very private and quiet. And so these different women with different communication styles and different goals just bump into each other for years until I think they find a path forward. I think that their relationship is central to the book because, as sisters, they will or will not have the next generation. They will or will not add to the quilt. So their relationship affects how the whole family goes forward, and in the end, how the whole family views the current time and their past.
Yes. Yes. And the way you use the character of Glennie, her absence is what we note early in the book and as it progresses, and largely because it is pointed out by Sarah. But I think then the fact that she still has this Sarah has this constant awareness of what Glennie is or isn't doing, that we as the reader then come to expect or anticipate what is going to happen with these two sisters, that even when they're trying to get together or be together, sometimes it's very difficult.
I think part of the problem with Sarah and Glennie as well is there's a whole thread in the novel about control. Who will tell the family history? Who will write family history? And how exactly will they phrase things? You know, Sarah has a very definite vision of what family is. And part of that is that you show up. Glennie also has issues of control. Hers being related to food. And so there are all kinds of battles in the book for connection and self-control, and for Glennie for a while, for survival.
Another thread in the book, as in our lives, is loss. And even when loss is anticipated or expected, there still is something very searing about it when it happens. And there are other losses that are experienced in the book as well. And so talk a little bit about that, because some of what I perceived is that we don't always know in life or in these characters what, say, our parents had experienced. Like, for instance, Al's parents are characterized, but there's something deeper there that really we never get to know about, but that I think is the case in families sometimes. You don't know what is defined the generation before you. And this book is very multi-generational. So I don't know, I threw a lot out there, but maybe you could respond to that whole idea of living with loss.
I think so much of this book is about history, and not just family history. Sarah's grandfather served in World War I. He served in World War II. And it is as much a book about moving on and living and taking the best of things and connecting as we can as it is about loss. But yes, it is about loss. And I think more than that, it's about how we manage loss. And so through history, Sarah has an example of her grandfather managing losses he cannot speak about. There are silences in what he's able to share in conversations. And she and Al respect and Glennie, all those silences. But those, again, are places where people start filling in gaps. And there is something unknowable about what happened to Grandpa Ed. And I think at the end, as Sarah ages, she becomes less rigid in how she views history and family and loss. She becomes more accepting of those silences. Yes. And I think she holds on to what's best.
Yes. Al, her husband, is, as you said, he's kind of, I don't remember the term you used. He kind of is a very gentle strength in the book, but also there's something so sensitive about him, and that he also, he has a great amount of compassion, yet he holds a lot of grief as well. So maybe talk a little bit about Al.
I love Al, and I often hear from readers that they love Al as well. Sometimes that's their first sentence. I love Al. And I think it's because he has such a generous, open-hearted soul. He is a person who was bullied and teased a lot as a child, and yet maintains a very open heart toward people and a very forgiving heart. And then he bumps into this family. He's never had such a boisterous, close family. And for all their failings, Sarah's family is close. And he just loves it. He loves it all. But he's a lot more forgiving than any of them are. And so he has to learn to hold himself amidst all that, to keep his heart amidst all that. His grief is often born quietly, but Sarah knows it's there, and Sarah is there for him. There's a scene in the book where she is not able to attend a funeral he has to attend, but she is there with the door open the minute he steps on the porch. So he is a very giving, loving person.
But there is a time in their relationship where she goes away with their daughter, Amelia, for a spell. And I think that got his attention. It got my attention. And it was something, though, that it seemed like Sarah needed to do. And it seemed like it was all about not just her grief, but almost more so his.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I think at that point in the novel, everybody knows how much Sarah values family. And so for her to take a break is pretty stunning. It is out of character, but it comes from a place in which I think she feels she needs to step away and be silent. She knows if she leaves her daughter with Al, that the daughter is too young to understand that departure. So it's not quite the retreat she needs 100%, but it allows her to catch her breath. I think that's what she needs at that point in her life. And Al accepts it. I think he knows that if he pushes, she'll break. I think everyone understands she needs that interlude to collect herself. But in that interlude, Al also comes to terms with some emotions he didn't fully recognize he needed to more fully face.
For our readers and for our listeners, I guess I want you to get a sense that this is a book about family, but also that, Caitlin, you're just such a lovely storyteller with words. And I don't know, just the way you pull us in, and I really appreciate your use of language and just the craft you've perfected in this novel.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I deeply appreciate that.
I think you have a good achievement here with this book, and
thank you.
Congratulations on getting it published. And I think I want to let people know also that you do lead a literary life. I mean, you are a publicist for very many writers, and you serve a very important purpose in getting their work out. And can you tell us anything about that?
Sure. I have been a book publicist for about 20 years. So I also do book marketing, and I own my own firm with my husband, Rick, who actually serves as my publicist for my books. And we love it. I mean, I believe, and I've said over and over, that stories have the power to connect us And sometimes stories save us. And I just think it's so important that we share our stories. I think it's just a privilege to be able to work on behalf of writers, helping their stories find their readers. I just think I'm very lucky to be able to work and read and live in this literary place that we've carved out for ourselves.
Caitlin Hamilton Summey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Caitlin Hamilton Summey, and her novel is Geographies of the Heart by Fomite Press. I first became acquainted with Caitlin through her role as publicist for several of the authors we've featured over the years on this show. However, when I discovered she was a writer and the grace and caliber of her writing, I had to bring her to you. Earlier in the show, we featured Barbara Graham with her book, What Jonah Knew, published by Harper, with a shout-out to her publicist, Julia Drake. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank you for listening. We have production assistance from James Morey, Mark Prell, and Wendy Nicholson. You could subscribe and listen to our podcast anytime at krcb.org, follow the program or podcast links, or download the KRCB app to your Android or Apple device and listen anytime, even in the garden or while taking a walk. We're a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Northern California Public Media. It's a novel idea.